Good idea or a fool's errand today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Trump administration considers more U.S. boots on the ground in Afghanistan, and this veteran asks,
for what? It's just incredibly, mind-numbingly ridiculous, and it just makes me angry.
Also, female vets in Vermont fight for respect.
When I came home on leave, people that knew me in my hometown said, do you know there are only two kinds of women that join the service, whores and lesbians, so which one are you?
Plus, what's up with those EB-5 visas for wealthy investors?
The vetting procedures for these EB-5 investors are not as stringent as the typical person trying to come into the U.S.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thank you for being here. We kick off today with news from the Groundhog Day desk. The administration in Washington is close to making a decision on whether to send more troops to Afghanistan. We've heard that for, the last 15 years. In a moment, how the idea sits with U.S. veterans. The difference now, of course, is that we're hearing this from the Trump administration. Officials are reportedly considering the deployment of an extra 3,000 to 5,000 troops with the goal of breaking the deadlock in Afghanistan. Michael Gordon reported the story for the New York Times. So one of the hardest lessons learned of military history is that you reinforce success. You don't reinforce failure. So what's going on here?
Well, it's a complicated situation, but the truth is the Obama administration's policy is the policy that failed. President Obama came in saying it was a war of necessity. But by the end of his term in office, he was pretty much trying to wind down the war and reduce forces there. And that was hard to do because the security situation there was still very difficult. So he handed off the Afghan conflict to the next administration, and they've taken a look at it. And what they're proposing to do is reverse the Obama downturn with a very modest increase, really. We're talking about 3,000 to 5,000 U.S. troops. We're not talking anything like the 30,000 strong surge that the Obama administration tried.
Is it the Afghan government that's asking for the help, or the U.S. commander there, or is it Washington that's saying, we think you need more troops?
Well, here's the situation. Security there is deteriorating. And so if you just let things stand as they are, and there are about 8,400 U.S. troops there now involved in a kind of advisory mission and also some counterterrorism action, you're basically presiding over a slow decline in security. So that doesn't seem like an attractive option. Sending tens of thousands of additional U.S. forces is out of the question. We've tried that before, as you pointed out. Pulling out altogether would create a security vacuum that al-Qaeda or ISIS affiliates and groups like that might exploit, and we'd be back a little bit to where we were in 2001. So looking at this array of bad options, what the Pentagon and also the American commander in Kabul, General Nicholson, and really the Afghan government, because they know they need American support, is proposing an increase on the order of several thousand troops, which would primarily be advisors, but not entirely be advisors, would be sort of special operations forces. And the goal is not to win a victory. That seems impossible. The goal is to somehow bloody the Taliban enough that they'll come to the negotiating table with the Afghan government. But as you pointed out, that's been tried before and hasn't worked.
Well, it tried before with 100,000 troops at its peak in Afghanistan, and now we're just talking 3,000 with the hope of breaking the deadlock. What difference can 3,000 troops actually make?
Well, I think they could make a difference if it's in combination with other measures. For example, I mean, right now, according to General Nicholson, there's not enough advisors there to work with Afghan forces at the lower level of the chain of command. Also, they can remove, you know, some of the constraints on operations there. So if you added 3,000 to 5,000 U.S. troops and you got a like number NATO troops, you could plus up the existing effort and try to reverse the deterioration and regain the momentum. I think it could make a difference. I mean, we have by maybe 6,000 troops in Iraq working with the Iraqi forces, and over time they've made gains in rolling back the Islamic State. But there's still some big questions to ask. One big question is, it doesn't seem like any strategy could be effective as long as Pakistan remains a sanctuary for the Taliban and extremist groups. And what I don't see in the strategy, as it's been disclosed so far, is a solution to that sanctuary problem.
When will we know the details about what's planned?
My guess is that we'll know soon, because there's a NATO summit on May 25th. And the reason the recommendation is coming to President Trump's desk is because they want this decision made before the NATO summit, because that then becomes the occasion to solicit contributions from NATO nations. So I think we're just going to know in the next couple of weeks. And I think it's going to be important to this White House that NATO also make a significant contribution, that it's not just an American contribution.
That was Michael Gordon of the New York Times. We wanted to hear what military veterans make of this, the possible deployment of more U.S. troops to Afghanistan by the Trump administration. So we asked our community of vets, and here's what some of them had to say.
My name is John Hartnett. I was a naval aviator from 1996 to 2005. I served in the United States Navy. I flew helicopters, and I was part of the initial invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 and 2002. I think that sending more troops is going to help ensure that those people who we've been supporting over the years can be assured that we continue to support them. And it also prevents chaos from developing out of the gap of power.
My name is Walt Mills. I'm from Dallas, Texas. I served in the Vietnam era in the Navy. I have a son who is in the Army currently. He spent 15 months in Afghanistan. He spent 1 year in Iraq. He spent a year over in South Korea. And of the three, the Iraq and Afghanistan took its largest toll on him. I think the toll that he took is greater than the effects of the benefits that we gained. And I believe that the benefits that we might get from that type of action with boots on the ground are certainly not worth the human and psychological toll that it takes on our troops.
My name is Jim Bullion from Millis, Massachusetts. I'm a retired U.S. Army colonel. I served two combat tours in Iraq, and I was also the director of the Pentagon's Task Force for Business and Stability Operations in Afghanistan, charged with helping to strengthen and rebuild the Afghan economy. I think the president's proposed increase in troop strength are way overdue and will help reverse the dramatic deterioration in the security situation in Afghanistan that has been happening over the last 2 years. The threat is not just to the Afghan people, but it's actually a direct threat to the U.S. and our allies. You know, one of the stated goals in the war for Afghanistan was to make sure that it would never again become a base of operations for the export of violent extremism. And yet that's exactly what would happen if we were to again abandon it.
Joe Hudak, I'm from San Diego, California. I served for three deployments, a total of about 2.5 years in Special Forces in the Army. My personal experiences over there, I realized that in Special Operations, we were trying to make a difference. And realistically, the confines between our own political leash that we were wearing, as well as the different cultures in Afghanistan and the Middle East in general, there was no way that I could see the local people actually coming on board and taking up a banner of Western ideology and the values that America was trying to force feed. And I don't feel as though my experiences overseas or in the 20 years that I was in special operations that there was any real change.
My name is Darcella Craven. I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. I served in the United States Army from 1988 to 1996, and I was a proud Signal Corps soldier in the military. We are a country that's been at war for 26 years, and we don't behave as such. And here is a person sending our men and women back into harm's way for what? It's just incredibly, mind-numbingly ridiculous, and it just makes me angry.
All the veterans you just heard from are part of our network of vets. We often turn to them for their insight into the stories we're covering. To join the community, just text RETURN to 69866. That's the word RETURN to 69866. And thanks for connecting with us. Women make up about 10 to 15% of the U.S. military, but many of those women feel like their stories and experiences are often overlooked. A group of cartoonists has a plan to change that. Rebecca Sinanis has our story from White River Junction, Vermont.
Watercolors and loose sheets of paper are spread across a large table at the White River Junction Veterans Affairs Medical Center. Conversation buzzes as women veterans share their stories, some for the first time, with cartoonists from the Center for Cartoon Studies, a White River Junction-based school for aspiring cartoonists and illustrators. Together, they'll create a cartoon strip about women's experiences in the military. Sarah Nolan was in the Navy.
I was active duty for 9 years, and I've been a reservist ever since, so I have about 23 years total. And this book that he's looking at is actually kind of a photo album of my Afghanistan deployment in 2012 and 13.
Nolan points out pictures of herself to artist J.D. Lund as he quickly sketches, working to get the details of her uniform just right.
That's quite an outfit.
I know. So I carried, I had a pistol and a rifle that I carried when I was...
Lunt is the cartoonist who helped spearhead this project. After doing a previous book with the VA about veterans' issues called When I Returned, he noticed that there were no women portrayed in that book. Now, he wants to change that.
These are stories that we know aren't heard nearly enough. And it's especially in the culture that we're swimming in right now, to get to amplify that voice and share that voice and get to do what we love, which is making comics, sharing these important stories is just the biggest honor.
Gail Fancher, a retired member of the Air Force, and her son John describe what it was like growing up and traveling as a family in the military.
Well, he had to get uprooted.
Kurt Schaffert scribbles furiously, trying to capture their stories and likeness in cartoon form.
So he was in... four or five, six different schools. So he had to have new friends everywhere he went. And sometimes it's easy to make, and sometimes it wasn't.
But other stories are darker, like Joya Catabriga, who served for 10 years between the 70s and 80s, everywhere from Fort Dix, New Jersey, to Frankfurt, Germany. She says her biggest threat during that time was not the enemy, but her male peers.
I hated the everyday politics and the fact that women were blamed for so much. And we were really, really resented, I think, and regarded as freaks. When I came home on leave, people that knew me in my hometown said, "Do you know there are only two kinds of women that join the service, whores and lesbians. So which one are you?"
And that's part of the reason why Carrie Russ, the women's program manager at the White River Junction VA, co-wrote a grant to the VA Innovators Network, a national program developed in 2015 that funds projects aimed at helping veterans and are conceived by people within the VA network. 22 VA sites around the country are part of that program. Most projects granted money by the VA Innovators Network deal with medical treatment. But Russ thought the arts had a place in veterans' affairs, too.
Women still feel invisible. They still feel like their stories aren't heard and their experiences aren't heard. And they often will tell me, you know, people still don't know that women are in the military and that women are veterans. And I think that it's really validating for women who have served alongside men for many years to be, you know, to be thought of as their equal counterpart, because, of course, they are.
The women will continue to meet with cartoonists throughout the year, and together they'll create a series of illustrated stories that will be shared with VA women's programs around the country. For The World, I'm Rebecca Sinanis in White River Junction, Vermont.
Rebecca reported that story for our Across Women's Lives project. Why it's complicated for the freed Chibok girls in Nigeria, that's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. There was some good news out of Nigeria this past weekend. The militant group Boko Haram released 82 of the schoolgirls they had kidnapped from a rural school more than 3 years ago. In exchange, Nigeria's government released several Boko Haram prisoners. Apparently, though, not all of the abducted girls were enthusiastic about returning home.
Some girls were not willing to be in the group of released girls.
That's writer Adobe Trisha Nobani in Nigeria's capital, Abuja. She spoke with Zana Mustafa, who helped broker the deal between Nigeria's government and Boko Haram.
So he went into the forest on the border with Cameroon, got the girls, handed them over to the Red Cross, and the Red Cross, you know, the security services and everything else, and they were brought to meet the president. The understanding I got from what he said is that certain girls refused to leave.
Is there some suspicion that they've kind of taken on the beliefs of their captors, that maybe they're suffering from a kind of Stockholm syndrome?
I spoke with a psychologist, Dr. Fatima Akilu, a psychologist in Nigeria who's worked with a lot of women who have been rescued from Boko Haram captivity. She said there could be a number of reasons. It could be Stockholm syndrome, the girls identifying with their captors and adopting their ideology. It could be that the girls, they have families, they have children, and don't want to be torn from those lives that they've settled into. And then she said the third thing is, we really don't know how much influence the insurgents and then the men they've been married to have in this decision.
Is it possible that life for these girls was better living under Boko Haram?
I've spoken with dozens of girls who were rescued from Boko Haram. I spoke with a woman. She became a woman called Aishari Yerima. She was married to a top Boko Haram commander called Mama Nur, who's known to the international media, and he has a bounty on his head. He was accused of being the mastermind behind the bombing of the UN, United Nations building here in Abuja. Now, she was married to that man, and she was kidnapped, but got married to him and became quite powerful. She boasted to me about the power she exercised as the commander's wife, you know, becoming almost the commander herself. She told me she actually went to battle with him once, accompanied him to battle. Now, this same woman has been released, spent a while going through a de-radicalization program in government custody, finally released after 1 year, and she's now with her family. Now, she was supposed to come to Abuja for something, and then her father says he doesn't allow her to leave. So I tried to imagine how a woman like that will feel. She was so powerful in the forest, and here she is now, being controlled by her father, telling her where to go and where not to go.
Adobe, what have you been able to find out about how religious life is under Boko Haram? Is the orthodoxy similar to what we hear about ISIS-held towns in Syria?
I've interviewed Chibok girls, released girls, and I've read the confidential reports from their debriefing, and all of them said, none of us were raped. I wasn't raped. And then the girls I know as well who were with the core Boko Haram, the ones with the commanders and with the top people we read about, they also say they were never raped. They were persuaded to get married, but not until you got married was any man allowed to touch you in any sexual way. And anyone who sexually molested any woman was dealt with. I heard that that holes were dug in the ground, that the men put inside and stoned or their heads slashed up. So these people, they're different from what we've been made to believe. I don't understand them completely, and I doubt if anybody does yet. I think we just rushed and made some assumptions, and we haven't quite understood them. That's why I'm looking forward to getting to interview people, the core Boko Haram, not just the ones that are caught stealing goats and chickens and bags of rice, not those kind, the people in command, because I don't think we really understand who they are. Like the girls say, nobody was forced to marry. They persuaded us, they flogged us and said you must, but nobody was forcibly taken to be someone's wife. So there's some sort of ideology there or some sort of code of conduct they've adopted. When I share these stories with friends who are devoted Muslims, they say, but it's still un-Islamic to take the girls. And yes, you married her, but we're her parents there. So we have those issues. But I think we don't quite understand their means and their methods yet.
Nigerian writer Adobe Trisha Nobani lives in Nigeria's capital, Abuja. Her most recent novel is I Do Not Come to You by Chance. Thanks for being with us again, Adobe.
Thank you, Marco.
This next story also involves people with roots in Nigeria and education, higher education, that is, in the UK. Around 3% of Britain's population is black, but at top British universities, you often don't even see that small percentage reflected in the student body. So a group of students at the prestigious University of Cambridge decided to do something about that. They posted a photo. It showed 14 young black students posing in front of one of the many Cambridge colleges, and this message: young black men don't grow up thinking they'll make it here. They should. That was a quote from one of the students in the photo, Dami Adebayo.
Young black people have lots of great role models in sports, in music, in acting, all sorts of things. But there's not enough black people out there who are doing things in an academic capacity that are basically inspiring the youth to chase those sorts of dreams.
When you first got to Cambridge a couple of years ago, how surprised were you to see so few black students?
Personally, on a personal level, I wasn't too surprised. I kind of knew what I was getting into. So I actually grew up in Scotland until I was about 9 years old, and I was one of the very few black people in my school there too. So it's never, for me, I've always been used to being a sort of oddity in that way, and it hasn't affected me in the way that I feel left out, because I feel like it's made me more adaptable. But coming here, it was a shame almost to see an institution which is regarded so highly not having such a diverse group of students, when having a diverse group of students, in my opinion, makes an institution hold so much more credibility and respectability.
Yeah, speaking of diversity, it is pretty noticeable that there are only men in this photograph. Why did you decide not to include women?
So the photograph was inspired by students in Yale University, hashtag Black Men of Yale University.
Right.
They started
mm-hmm.
it. We were basically inspired by them, and it was our ACS president who came up with the idea to do it here in Cambridge. So, and our ACS president is actually a woman. So in hindsight, we feel like we definitely should have integrated it, because we've gotten a lot of backlash, and it's almost taken away from the movement, because really we're just trying to say it's for all black youth out there.
The black population in the U.S. is about 13-14%. And when you peek inside a university cafeteria, you can almost assess with the naked eye whether that looks like 15% representation or not. Like, is
yeah.
a school trying hard to get there? But 3% black population in the UK, that sounds like it's a population that could almost go missing if you were not paying attention. Talk about that. Does it sometimes feel as if there are not enough people in that block?
It really depends on what part of the UK you're in. So as I said, for me growing up in Scotland, it would be rare to see a black person there. But if you're in inner city London, the percentage is very much concentrated within inner city of London and Birmingham and places like that, Manchester. So, but if you were to come somewhere like Cambridge, then if you take a picture of the student population, if you were to go to, say, one college here, it's very unlikely that you would see a black person. So it kind of, it depends where you are.
So how do you feel about percentages? I mean, I don't want to call it a quota because that gets into very controversial territory. But do you think a place like Cambridge should represent, you know, Scotland where you grew up, or should it represent London?
The crazy thing is a lot of the students here are coming from London, but they're coming from the more privileged schools in London. So I just feel it should represent London because we're so close to London. We're 45 minutes away from London. And a lot of the students who are applying here anyway from better off backgrounds are coming from London. So it definitely shouldn't look anything like Scotland, in my opinion.
Even though some people might say, well, that's not what the rest of the country really looks like.
True. But I think that the biggest issue is if you just look at who's applying, the ratios of who's applying, there was something like less than 250 black people from the UK applied, which is an incredibly low number. So I feel like that number has got to increase, and it should, in my opinion, be as diverse as possible.
That's Dami Adebayo, a second-year engineering student at the University of Cambridge in Britain.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. A brother and sister leave their mother behind in a mountain village in El Salvador, headed for California. The mother misses them, but she's glad they're safe.
3 months ago, they assassinated two kids right here, like exactly the age of my kids.
The family story is still ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Another day, another election result. Democracy marches on. Yesterday, France got a new president. Today, it's South Korea's turn. The winner there, by a landslide, according to exit polls, is Moon Jae-in. He worked as a human rights lawyer and replaces the impeached former president, Park Geun-hye. We reached Jason Strother in Seoul for the latest.
Marco, I just got out of a very big Moon Jae-in victory rally in Gwanghwamun Plaza. That was the epicenter of the candlelight vigils, the protests against former President Park Geun-hye. At this rally, I mean, his supporters are, you know, electrified. He took to the stage. He thanked everyone. He said that, you know, together they're making a country of justice, and that under his administration, rules and common sense will prevail. And that's pretty clear reference to the corruption scandal that brought down his predecessor.
So the place where anti-corruption protests grew last year is where the anti-corruption candidate and now the new president kind of makes his rallying cry on Victory Day. What does he stand for? How has he promised to move South Korea forward?
Moon Jae-in, throughout this campaign, has championed economic equality, social justice. He has reached out to South Korean youths who are suffering very high unemployment rate right now. He's pledged to make hundreds of thousands of new jobs. Corruption was the main issue in this election. Many of his supporters, and he had many, he won by a very clear margin in the election today, they're pegging their hopes on him that after what they see is a very corrupt administration, that he'll come in and clean house.
So apparently Moon supports engagement with North Korea. What does he mean when he says that exactly?
Sure. Well, he wants better relations with North Korea. He has said that he would hold a summit with the North Korean ruler, Kim Jong-un, but conditions including the North pledging to give up its nuclear weapons program would have to be on the table first. But I think some more tangible engagement strategies that Moon might try out is, for one, restarting the shuttered Kaesong Joint Industrial Complex. That's a factory zone just north of the border where over 100 South Korean firms employed tens of thousands of North Korean workers. They were cheap labor. Last year, President Park closed down that factory complex. She said that money was going to help fund North Korea's weapons programs. Moon has stated that he'd like to see it reopened. So if he's serious about improving ties with the North, this could be first on his agenda.
So kind of engagement and not so much sword rattling. How would Washington see the Moon Jae-in strategy, do you think?
Seoul right now is pretty confused what Washington's stance is on North Korea. You know, it wasn't that long ago that President Trump threatened to attack North Korea if it conducted another nuclear test or launched ballistic missiles. And then President Trump has come out saying that he'd be honored to have dinner with Kim Jong-un. So I think that has Seoul pretty confused about what Washington's policy is. However, though, this could make Moon and Trump strange bedfellows if they are really both serious on wanting to engage Pyongyang.
Just a couple of biographical details I found interesting about Moon Jae-in. He was born in 1953 during the Korean War, and his parents fled from the North, sailing for 3 days on the deck of a U.S. ship packed with refugees. Do you know how that experience shaped his politics and his worldview?
His mother is evidently still alive. She's in her 90s, and is still holding out hope that her sister that she left behind in North Korea is still alive. I think that's a common story for many South Koreans. You know, there were tens of thousands of North Koreans that fled during the war, and often with the help of American forces. Moon's story is really common, and I think that family history could very well play a part in his desire for better relations that could eventually lead to reunification.
Finally, Jason, we had fun talking about the K-pop songs that played such a big role in the campaign. Moon is now the president. Was his campaign song also number one?
Obviously, his repurposed K-pop songs had a lot to do with the success he had in the polls today, Marco. And maybe we better listen to it one more time before we...
Oh, no, really? Are you queuing it up?
Let's hear it. Moon Jae-in, Moon Jae-in, Moon Jae-in,
Moon Jae-in, Kim Ho-gil-bok. Jason Strother and Seoul, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Marco. Moon Jae-in, Moon Jae-in, Moon Jae-in, Moon Jae-in, Moon Jae-in, Moon
Jae-in, Kim Ho-gil-bok. Okay, let's pick up on another story from yesterday. This one about two siblings from El Salvador who live in Riverside, California. Last year, they escaped gang violence and crossed into the U.S. Their story is similar to that of thousands of other young Central Americans who've made that dangerous journey alone in recent years. Today, Tipa Fernandez takes us to the rural mountain village where Kevin and Sandra Mejia were born and raised. That's where Tipa met the sibling's mother in her makeshift outdoor kitchen.
There's no store around here to buy tortillas high up in this rural mountain village in El Salvador. So Isabel Mejia pounds her masa into round discs. She adds some wood to the fire kindling under her large pan and throws down the dough tortillas to cook. She knows what she's doing, but as I stick my microphone near her pounding hands near the fire, she's puzzled "What am I doing recording everything?" she asks. "I want to show what your life is like," I tell her.
"How we live here, right? In poverty, right? In poverty, I'm telling you. All we eat is little beans and tortillas. That's it, right? Just maíz and beans."
Her kitchen is a thatched roof mud hut with an open fire pit to cook on. It's Sunday, so today she's making a special meal, rice with carrots. Back in the main house, Mejia plugs in an old, clunky blender to mix up a zesty salsa.
People here all work on agriculture, like on coffee estates. That's how we live here.
There are many mouths to feed in Mejia's home. She lives with her 79-year-old mother and one of her daughters, Daisy, who has her own child. Another daughter is visiting with her child. Her sons all have kids too. Daisy says life is hard in their small village.
Here, if we want to bathe, we have to get up at 5 a.m., and it takes us 2 hours to get there. And we come back on nice and bathe, but then we're all sweaty too.
This was where Kevin Mejia and his older sister Sandra lived until 10 months ago, when they left to try and make it to the U.S. by themselves.
I miss them a lot, a lot. They were my two children. Kevin was the youngest.
Kevin was just 13 when they left, and Sandra was 14. Mejia says she's often very sad.
I was fat, but now I'm really thin. Even my children, they see me and they say, "Oh, Mama, you're so thin." Yes, I tell them, "I miss you a lot, and you know how we live here. Here just about everybody goes hungry."
So why did they leave? Kevin says he was escaping the gangs. He has a pending asylum case based on the fear of retaliation by gang members for not joining them. Yet this sleepy little village doesn't feel like gang turf. But Mejia says the dangers are all around.
3 months ago, they assassinated two kids right here. It's really the young ones, these gangs in El Salvador, are after. Like exactly the age of my kids.
The road leading to her home, curving around the mountain, it's deserted.
Kids can't go to another village. The outskirts of our town are dangerous. They have to stay home or they will be targeted.
I ask her why parents don't protect their children from gangs.
Well, here, we can't protect our children. As a mother, a single mother, I can't protect them against all this violence we have here in El Salvador. I can't protect them.
With lunch done, Mejia's daughter Daisy gets her 3-year-old ready for church. It's the one family outing they do each week. The little children are excited to be getting ready to go out. The drive to church is along a very rocky and secluded road. Mejia points out the coffee estate where she works Monday through Saturday. I ask to see Kevin and Sandra's school. We take a small detour. About a mile later, we arrive into the town center. We pull up by a walled-off compound that has two bright blue buildings, the school where Kevin and Sandra attended.
The teachers here are good. They teach them a lot.
A bit further on, we arrive at Mejia's church. It's an evangelical Christian church. Mejia approaches an empty seat, kneels backwards and puts her head down on the plastic chair. She has a lot to pray for.
All I ask God is that my children can live there. I hope they win the case so they can stay.
They're far away from her in Riverside, California, but they're never out of her heart, she tells me. Then it's back to the church service. For The World, Deepa Fernandez, Cantón del Pinalón, El Salvador.
Deepa's reporting was supported by the International Women's Media Foundation and its Adelante Latin America Reporting Initiative. You know, some people don't have such problems when they cross borders. Take this news about President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and a possible conflict of interest involving China. As you may have heard, Kushner's sister was in Beijing recently, urging wealthy Chinese to invest in a Kushner company's project here in the U.S. In exchange, these wealthy Chinese would gain access to the U.S. government's EB-5 visa program. It allows foreigners who invest at least $500,000 here in this country to jump to the head of the immigration line. President Trump, i.e. Kushner's father-in-law, renewed the program a few months ago. Bloomberg reporter Caleb Melby says the EB-5 program is definitely legal, but it can be abused.
The Government Accountability Office, the investigative arm of Congress, has put out reports that basically say that where the funds come from is impossible to trace in most cases. We don't have good vetting procedures for looking at who these people are, where they got their money from. Again, it's a little ironic. Trump has touted extreme vetting, but the vetting procedures for these EB-5 investors are not as stringent as the typical person trying to come into the U.S.
So it seems the Kushner companies are trying to attract Chinese investors. Tell us about what Jared Kushner's sister did. What was she pitching to investors in China?
Jared Kushner's sister, Nicole Meyer, she went to Beijing and Shanghai, and she pitched potential investors in this EB-5 program in a new tower they're building out in New Jersey. It's Jersey City, right across the river from Manhattan. It's an interesting project in that they had been trying to build something there. They originally announced plans, you know, back in November of 2015. But the plan that they're pitching the Chinese is very different. It's much bigger. It's much more expensive. So there's a lot of unanswered questions here. But basically, now that they're going to China, which is something they were not doing in 2015, they're looking for more money for a bigger project.
They're having a tough go, I gather, making this whole project happen. I mean, that's why they're going to the Chinese. Is it, in fact, a good investment for the Chinese?
It's true. So they had originally planned on this revolutionary building with the startup WeWork, which does like tech incubator hubs. But those plans have fallen through. And at the same time, a lot of the government financing the Kushners were relying on to build this project has also fallen through. He has to rely on the mayor of Jersey City, which is a liberal city. They've seen a lot of protests around Trump's immigration actions. So now that they're out, they do have to look farther afield for funding, which includes these EB-5 pitches. Whether or not it's a good investment for these Chinese investors is really hard to say at this point. But we also know that when you invest through an EB-5 program, sometimes your return on investment is not always the primary reason you're going into business. It's for the citizenship.
Is the Kushner company, Jared or his sister, overtly or otherwise offering kind of access to the White House?
Nicole Meyer mentioned that her brother, Jared Kushner, had since left the company to go to the White House. And during the presentation, there was a photo of Donald Trump, who was listed as a key decision maker in the EB-5 program. The Kushner company has since apologized. They say what Nicole meant was to say that her brother was no longer involved with the company, not that his connection to the White House makes the project any more viable. Now, whether or not they intended for it, the signal was clear.
A lot of this stuff is pretty complex, the visa process, the ethics, and I think some people's eyes may glaze over. So Jared Kushner and his company carry on. The Chinese investors get their visas. Does this become business as usual amid the white noise of Trump world? We just forget about these conflicts of interest?
I mean, we've seen a lot of reporting on this so far because it is just so unprecedented, the financial and business ties that this presidency and the president's family bring to the White House. So I expect you'll continue to hear more about it. Whether or not the public becomes sort of inured to these conflicts is an important question, I think. And it's kind of on reporters to make sure that we keep track of where conflicts are actually presenting themselves versus the possibility of conflicts. And I think this is definitely an example of there being a clear conflict. And I think one of the benefits of this story was getting to see Jared's sister in a ballroom in China talking about her brother and President Trump while trying to attract investment. And that, in that sense, if people's eyes are glazing over, this should definitely be an eye-popping moment.
That was Bloomberg reporter Caleb Melby speaking with us from New York. One of Latin America's top rock bands just released a new album last week, Café Tacuba from Mexico, and their album is called Hey Baby, where Hey is spelled J-E-I and Baby is B-E-I-B-I. Hey, it's a pronunciation thing. The World's William Troop has the disc on regular rotation and caught up with the members of Café Tacuba recently while they were touring here in the U.S.
There are a lot of different musical styles packed into this Café Tacuba album. It starts with Un, Dos, Tres and that classic rock and español feel. But it also goes to places Café Tacuba has rarely visited, like this thoughtful reggae cumbia combo called Enamorada. Yo te quiero decir que sin quererlo, esta luz encendió. De un amor que llegó para siempre quererlo. Like so much of what Café Tacuba has done over the years, Hey Baby defies easy labels. In fact, when I asked him if the label Mexican Rockers even applies to them at this point, here's what I got.
I mean, we grow up listening to rock, but we grow up listening to a lot of stuff. And since the beginning, we didn't define ourselves as a rock band. We just said that that was music at the time with the influence that were around. Now I think it's the same position.
That's keyboardist Meme del Real.
I believe that rock got to do more with an attitude than with a sound. When you say we are rockers, you just get into your mind a sound. But I think that the best way to define the Café Tacuba is to listening to their music, and each one of the listeners will have its opinion.
Which might just be another way to say the band has evolved a lot over their 28 years together. They started out as young punks, and now they're more mature and into different things. Meme says his new Café Tacuba album is about freedom, to experiment, to just find a new sound or idea and go with it. So yeah, they're sounding a bit different these days. Like, maybe they have a lot more to reflect on now that they're, sorry guys, middle-aged rockers. On El Mundo en que Nací, for instance, the lyrics are about a child being born and giving the parent a reason to keep going, and about the world that child will inherit. Heavy, what's life really about sort of lyrics. Nada jamás me ha hecho tan feliz. El día que llegaste a este mundo y por primera vez te vi, cargarte entre mis brazos y mi nariz. Entonces ese día supe que primero dejaría que un avión cayera sobre mí antes que algo se acercara. Y pudiera ser algo de daño en ti. And guess what? As the band has evolved and experimented, the fans in the audience have changed too. Here's how lead singer Rubén Albarrán puts it.
We had a very violent, aggressive punk audience in the beginning. And now we have all kind of audience. We can see youngsters, and we can see elders and very small children. The shows are more eclectic, even in the nationalities of the people that come to the shows.
That mix of nationalities in the audience is especially noticeable when Café Tacuba comes to the U.S. Fans at their concerts here tend to have roots all over Latin America, not just Mexico or any other specific country. And Rubén says you can sense a special connection during the shows.
A lot of people that came to this country with their music, with their culture, and maybe they are far from home, maybe they cannot go back, and their culture, their music seems to keep them closer to their people, to their land. So they are very emotional shows, and we love to play here.
Me gusta tu manera de besar. That emotion Ruben mentioned, it can sometimes get beyond intense. Meme remembers one Café Tacuba show in Atlanta where the fans were especially fired up. It was like a riot, he recalls. And then something weird happened.
There was this guy that jumped into the stage and then jumped again into the crowd, like 2-3 times. But in a certain point, he went up and he just took Ruben and he just grabbed him and he just jumped into the crowd with Ruben. And we said, what the? And we didn't know what happened because they went to the floor.
Turned out both Ruben and the fan were fine. But Meme says that's the kind of energy and passion people bring to the shows here in the U.S.
But it's just the way they have to release all this energy, all these feelings, all this nostalgic thing that they have. And we are pretty much the soundtrack of a celebration. And we understand that. We are happy to be part of that celebration.
Meme del Real, Rubén Albarrán, and the other members of Café Tacuba will be back on tour in the U.S. this fall. For The World, this is William Fruit.
Café Tacuba takes us out today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for making it here today.
PRI, Public Radio International.